Hey, my name's Jamie Poisson, and I'm the host of Front Burner. It's the CBC's daily news podcast. And every day, we're discussing the big events and fault lines shaping Canada and the world. Politics, economics, social movements, you name it. Sometimes we even talk about really fun stuff, like the enduring relevance of Lord of the Rings. You can hear Front Burner on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey there, I'm Rosemary Barton.
And I'm El Amin Abdul Mahmoud.
And this is Party Lines.
And the day that this podcast drops, Rosie, Alberta is unveiling a brand new 2021 budget. It's coming at a time when Premier Jason Kenney finds himself in a pretty bad place. His popularity has plummeted throughout the whole pandemic. Will the budget be enough of a boost to change how Albertans are feeling about their premier?
We will see. I also want to take a look at something the federal government put forward last week, and that is some new legislation that would relax penalties for certain drug offenses. Doesn't go as far as the notion of decriminalizing certain drugs. That's something that advocates, mayors, public health leaders have been calling for. But is it a sign of something happening, especially as the opioid crisis continues to devastate lives in this country?
Some big topics. Let's get to it.
Let's do it.
So the day that folks hear this show, Alberta will be the very first province to give its people a 2021 budget. Isn't that exciting? You love budgets, Rosie.
I do love a budget, even one that I'm not directly involved in. I do love a budget.
Exactly. Like, there's just so many budgets that are coming soon. Like, PEI is going to have a budget. New Brunswick's going to have a budget. Ontario's going to have a budget. Those are all within the next month or so.
So
it's going to be budget season out here. But the first out the gate is Alberta. And the reason this is a big deal is because this is a province that has been hit particularly hard, you know, not just by the pandemic, but a bunch of different factors for a few years. The price of oil, of course, Joe Biden saying he's going to scrap Keystone XL. It is a bleak time. And to give you an idea of how bleak it is, last year, Alberta's deficit was already high. It was $6.8 billion. But then it ballooned a lot higher to $21 billion. Not the largest in the country or anything, but for a province that like prides itself so much on fiscal responsibility, a province that preaches that you gotta spend just what you bring in, it's pretty politically significant because that deficit is not going to be eliminated in this budget that the United Conservative Party rolls out. Premier Jason Kenney said there's not going to be any new taxes, but this budget will be focused on jobs and on healthcare, which leaves us to ask the question, how are you going to do that? Like, how are you going to raise enough money? Because, yes, oil prices have rebounded a little bit, at least like from the hit that it's taken since the pandemic began. But it's nowhere near high enough for Alberta to be doing something that's this ambitious.
Yeah, and I think that then that sort of brings you to the question of what exactly is Jason Kenney doing out there?
Yeah.
Because when he went back to Alberta to merge the right, the two conservative parties that were out there, Wild Rose and the Conservative Party, it was really to try and reclaim the conservative mantle in that province, right? After an NDP government led by Rachel Notley, he promised to promote the Alberta advantage. He promised to balance the budget. He promised to shrink the size of the public service. He did not obviously anticipate a pandemic and a slump in oil prices and layoffs and all sorts of things. But what he also has not really been able to show, and we'll see whether the budget shows any change in this, is he has not been able to adapt to these new realities that he is faced with as premier. He's kept the plan from before. He wanted to cut doctors' pay in the midst of a pandemic. He still wanted to shrink the size of the public service. He just hasn't been able to realize that the situation has changed so dramatically. And so this budget in some ways is also a test of whether he has figured it out yet, because he's had a really, really tough year, a tougher year than a lot of premiers, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, I have to imagine if you are Jason Kenney, like this was not the plan. Like, this, none of this was a plan, because Kenny was in federal politics for almost 20 years. Yeah. He was Minister of Defense. He was Minister of Multiculturalism. He was Minister of everything under the sun under Stephen Harper. So when he went back to Alberta back in 2017, he was kind of a superstar get, you know? And you mentioned that, like, he united the conservative parties in Alberta. That's significant because it really felt like the conservative movement in Alberta at that time was reeling from Rachel Notley's election. Mm-hmm. Because the NDP had won, and it was almost like, here is this, like, federal conservative massive figure, national figure, who's coming in and saying, oh boy, do you need my help? And he did. He united that party. He became its first leader and won 55% of the vote in that election in 2019. And, like, not only does he win, but he has the amazing fortune of having a liberal government in Ottawa. And, like, one of Alberta's favorite sports, I assume, is being anti-Ottawa. Like, a big part of the DNA of governing in Alberta is saying, hey, I'm going to put Ottawa in its place. So how lucky is that? But then you get to this place now where we're 2 years into his run as premier, and he's having a fight on every front. Like, the idea that he's picking a fight with the doctors over pay in the middle of a pandemic just doesn't compute. And in fairness, like, that fight was before the pandemic. I remember that in February 2020, so, like, you know, a month before the pandemic began, his government said that it was going to impose this, like, limit on the fees that doctors can charge. But then later, you know, a month later, we enter into this global pandemic period. And subtly it seems like maybe it's an impolite time to pick a fight with doctors. I don't know. He's also fighting so many different factions in his own party over the COVID restrictions that he's put in place. Like, he wants to appear rational to people who want the government to guide them through the scary time, but also at the same time he wants to appear kind of libertarian to the people who are like, I want freedom to do what I want. And we get to this place now where Jason Kenney appears to be someone who, exactly like you said, is unable to adapt, unable to pivot with the circumstances. And I think what's interesting about this budget is that this is his first significant opportunity to do so in some time. And his polling numbers are so low that he's in desperate need of that pivoting.
Yeah, he is consistently, since the pandemic really began, him and the Premier of Manitoba, Brian Pallister, sort of battling it out for worst polling approval ratings across the country, which is surprising to anyone that knows Jason Kenney or knew Jason Kenney. When we decided we were going to talk about this, I thought back to an interview I did when he decided he was going to leave. I went over to his office in the Confederation Building, which is sort of just, you know, on the bottom of Parliament Hill. It's this big, beautiful office with lots of windows, and he's a remarkable intellect, really. He knows everything about history. His office was full of history books and royal paraphernalia and things from all his travels. And he was packing boxes and sitting on the corner of a desk and talking to me about all the things that he wanted to bring to Alberta, that he thought he could bring to Alberta. But in the sort of background of that conversation was the idea that maybe he could then one day come back to Ottawa and perhaps lead the Federal Conservative Party.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something he talks about so publicly, but it's always sort of been out there, right? That his ambitions were even bigger. But now he's found himself in this spot as the leader in Alberta, where he, as you say, has to somehow placate the people that elected him. So fiscal conservatives and, yes, libertarians, but also now govern for all of Alberta and for people who are feeling like they were abandoned, maybe by their own government, maybe by the federal government, and who are desperate because of the way they've been hit more than once in Alberta because of the oil slump and what have you. There was this one open letter that was written to the premier by his former opponent, Brian Jean, who was the leader of the Wild Rose Party. And he had a whole bunch of advice in this open letter. But I want to quote one because I just thought it actually was pretty smart. And it speaks to what you said about setting up that fight between Alberta and Ottawa all the time. And this is what Jean said. He said, quote, "Fire yourself as intergovernmental affairs minister and appoint a new one. Our current fight everyone style is not working. And then he goes on to say, we need a good cop, bad cop approach. And right now we don't even have a good cop. And I thought, if we are at the stage where his defeated opponent is having to give him good advice, really, about how to better collaborate with the federal government, you know, how bad are things for him right now? And how much is riding on this budget and his ability to, you know, try and reach out to some of the people that have... that are angry with him, frankly.
You know, it's interesting that you bring up the often talked about, but he will never mention them directly, ambitions that he has for federal office, for leading the Conservative Party, because he was, of course, really instrumental. Jason Kenney was really instrumental in Erin O'Toole's victory in the sense that it was a significant endorsement that Erin O'Toole got in that fight.
That's right.
And there's this strong feeling, you know, that we might get a federal election at some point this year. And if that ends up happening, I actually think Jason Kenney's popularity could be really significant. And here's why. Anthony Koch, who was a surrogate of Erin O'Toole, wrote in this piece for The Line about this dynamic that you and I have talked about before, which is that conservatives, if they want to win federally, they have to expand the base. They have to stop winning by like such large margins in ridings where they've already won it. And Koch pointed out that conservatives win by these huge margins in places like Alberta, but then lose kind of winnable races in Ontario where they actually need to win race. This is what he wrote. He wrote, conservatives will continue to lose if we don't at the very least risk losing some support in the conservative heartland in order to make gains in the parts of the country that elect prime ministers. And I think Koch, it would be fair to say, is like not talking about losing progressive conservatives. Like they would probably stick around. But a really popular Kenney could help keeping the risk to O'Toole to a minimum. But Kenney's waning popularity, on the other hand, could also offer this opportunity for Erin O'Toole to just move himself directly into the center, into the place where he says that he wants to move the party. And I think that sets up a really interesting potential scenario for the next federal election, don't you think?
Yeah, and I also think it could give a little more oxygen to Erin O'Toole, frankly. You know, if you don't have sort of a big voice and conservative superstar taking up a lot of space in a province, it might allow Erin O'Toole a little more room himself to shine.
Hi, I'm Damon Fairless, host of Hunting Warhead from CBC Podcasts and the Norwegian newspaper VG. Hunting Warhead follows a global team of police and journalists as they attempt to dismantle a massive network of predators on the dark web. Winner of the grand prize for best investigative reporting at the New York festivals and recommended by The Guardian, Vulture, and The Globe and Mail, you can find Hunting Warhead on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Last week, something happened that we didn't have time to talk about. We don't talk about everything. But one of the things we're seeing at the beginning of this year is that the government is not just trying to manage the pandemic, although, of course, they're doing that. But they're also trying to move into governing with other pieces of legislation to sort of lay down the groundwork for, you know, an election so that they have a record of doing things that they said they would do. And so to that end, they tabled a new bill to repeal mandatory minimum penalties for certain drug offenses. And it would also, if it becomes law, require police and prosecutors to consider alternatives instead of laying charges for simple possession. So would it be better for this person, you know, instead of convicting them of a drug offense and throwing them in jail, would it be better to send them to an addiction treatment program? Would it be better to give them a conditional sentence? This would end up repealing more than a dozen mandatory minimum penalties that are on the books, that were put on the books in the Harper government. It would keep some of the mandatory minimums for much more serious crimes like child abuse, child pornography, those kinds of things. But the government is really doing it for a couple of reasons. First of all, because the percentage of Indigenous offenders or people of color who end up in prison because of these mandatory minimums is very high. And they see this, the government sees this as a way to try and not target a certain group, a certain segment of the population. And because this government has increasingly talked about ways to move the conversation around drugs out of the crime and punishment justice realm and into a conversation about health, public health, and, you know, this being an addiction, an actual health problem, yeah, as opposed to a crime problem. And I think it's particularly important to talk about this year, Elamin, because as the pandemic has brought so many deaths to this country, and as those numbers have spiked, so too has the number of deaths related to opioids. It has been some of the highest numbers since national data began to be collected in 2016 in terms of the death rate. And I mean, I think that shows that what we're doing isn't working, and the government is recognizing that something has to change. I wonder what you think the significance of that bill is, or what it suggests to you about the direction we're headed in.
You know, I think every time that I spend time reading reporting about the opioid crisis, about the overdose crisis in this country, I'm reminded that it is an immense privilege to think of it as some kind of crime and punishment story, as some kind of story that has to do with, you know, what a society is willing to tolerate and what is not willing to tolerate. Because, like, that's traditionally how we viewed, you know, stories about drug policies and drug crime laws. Because if you live in Vancouver, like, this is not a story about that, you know? It's not even a controversial story in the sense that, you know, Vancouver has been so battered by the reality of this overdose crisis that the harm reduction conversation has moved from being, you know, should we take a harm reduction approach or should we not, to what degree should we incorporate it into our health policy, because this is a health crisis more than it is a crime crisis. And when I saw this story pop up, I was just reminded of that because, yeah, like, these kinds of laws have been kind of toxic for so many governments to touch, particularly federally, for a long time, because there are so many different perspectives on how we talk about drug laws and how we treat drug users. But we have gotten to the point where it is not healthy for us as a society to continue talking about it just in that realm and completely forget the harm reduction paradigm and to completely forget the reality that exists where so many people are hurt by these addictions, and it doesn't make any sense to continue just talking about addictions as a crime problem when it is in fact a health problem.
Yeah, and there's some other signs, I think, out there that that is where the conversation is moving. The Association of Chiefs of Police has asked for some of these changes and to consider the idea that decriminalizing drugs could be helpful in this. The conservative leader, Aaron O'Toole, has said that he's open to less severe penalties, so kind of what the government has now put on the agenda. The NDP leader, Jagmeet Singh, has said that he supports this piece of legislation, but he actually wants them to go much further and decriminalize drugs. Vancouver and Montreal have passed motions in city council to ask for exemptions so small amounts of drugs can be decriminalized. Now, that's something that they are doing, you know, for a political reason in their city. Then they now have to take that to the federal government and try and convince them to make that change. So there's something happening here. You know, there's something building in society to move this conversation in a different direction. I think the problem is that it remains politically fraught. If you think back to previous elections, when the Liberals, for instance, were campaigning on legalizing marijuana, cannabis, something that is now sort of not that interesting.
Oh my God,
a topic.
It's such a boring story.
Yeah, no one cares anymore.
Yeah.
It's just the stores are there, you order it, and it's just sort of gone the way you might expect. But at that time, the conservatives used that as a way to suggest that the Liberals were actually interested in doing much more in making sure that heroin and cocaine and other drugs could become legal too, which is not the conversation, but it does you know, sort of present some risk, I think, to the Liberals if that's, you know, the road that the Conservatives or others believe they could be drawn down. And you can see then why this conversation has to be rooted in exactly what you said. It has to be rooted in harm reduction and how do we keep people from dying, as opposed to all that political rhetoric that sort of, you know, that swirls around it constantly.
Mm-hmm. Well, to that end, you know, the Conservatives do say that they're looking for a more compassionate approach to drug users. And that's an interesting pivot from that party, because that is the party that introduced these mandatory minimum sentences that we have on the books now. Lives have been ruined by these mandatory minimum sentences. I remember in 2004, Julian Fantino, who at the time was a Toronto police chief, compared legalizing cannabis to legalizing murder in the Toronto Sun. I remember this very clearly. I remember reading that story. This is a man who then, when he went to federal politics, he helped pass those very same mandatory minimums. Mm-hmm. Well, wouldn't you know it, that immediately after, you know, cannabis was legalized, Julian Fantino was on the board. I think he was the executive chairman of Aleafia, a cannabis company. Mm-hmm. He was on the board for that company until I believe it was May of last year. So was former RCMP Deputy Commissioner Raf Sukar. And like, that is interesting to me, because it's pretty interesting how cannabis was as bad as literal actual murder until there was money to be made in it. But this is not that kind of show. So let me just collect myself for a moment and just pivot to this idea that like, yeah, we have progress as a society in terms of our understanding of how these issues should be treated. And part of that has been conservatives themselves making quite a bit of movement, whether it's motivated by either seeking more voters who have come to see this issue in a more complicated light, or by literal actual money. There has been movement, I think, in the factions of society who have for the longest time viewed drug problems as this like big moral stick to hit the other parties with. They're no longer doing that. And that sort of creates this opening right now.
Yeah. It's worth pointing out that the Prime Minister, that Justin Trudeau himself, doesn't believe that decriminalization is a silver bullet. And while the City of Vancouver has asked for small amounts to be decriminalized, and they've written to the Prime Minister and met with him, this is the Mayor, Kennedy Stewart, in Vancouver, they are still waiting to hear from the Health Minister and Health Canada about how they would go about doing that, allowing for small amounts to become legal. Because the idea is if some of these drugs are laced with other things, which is what is happening, then maybe there's a way for quote-unquote cleaner drugs to be available in safer places for these people with addictions. One of the things that has happened as a result of the pandemic is that the supplies for drugs has shrunk, frankly. And so they are seeing more drugs laced with things that people would not expect to be there that could kill them. And they are also seeing, because of the pandemic, that harm reduction sites where you might go to use a safe needle and use your drugs in a more safe environment have been closed because of the pandemic. So there are more people mm-hmm. dying at home alone. But not only that, there's some really sort of startling and shocking and disturbing numbers around this that, if nothing else, should force us to just stop for a moment and think mm-hmm. about whether this is a criminal issue, a justice issue, or a public health issue. The opioid crisis has now killed more than 20,000 Canadians since 2016. Mayor Kennedy Stewart of Vancouver says on average one person a day is dying. And mm-hmm. this statistic, which is startling, that life expectancy at birth did not increase from 2016 to 2017 for either males or females, a first in over a decade, because of the opioid crisis. And in particular, that is the case in British Columbia among young adult men. So if you ever needed evidence that this isn't working, surely those numbers should give politicians pause to think about what kind of public policy would work. I guess the question is, are we moving in that direction, and how far are we going to go?
I'm increasingly on the lookout for my "what the hell were you thinking, Dad" moment. And by that I mean like the moment that in a generation or like in 10 years or so, my daughter's going to look at me and be like, "Wait, your generation believed that? That's really wild that you guys believe this." And, you know, I think for me and my parents, like, that moment was how we talk about mental health, because huge changes have come.
Sure.
But I think my generation's is going to be addiction. Like, I think that the generation of my children will say, "Hey, like, I can't believe that your generation believed this about drug users," and believe you had the data and you had the options to pivot yourself to this approach that was much more compassionate, much more human, and just much more evolved understanding of what addiction is and what it does to people. And so many of you still chose to stick to the universe where you looked at it as a moral issue. That's just my suspicion, but I don't know what's to come.
That is, this is what Emma, the producer, wrote. That's the sound of me unloading the dishwasher this morning. What Emma doesn't know is I hate unloading the dishwasher and I refuse to do it. So that's the sound of someone unloading the dishwasher this morning.
It's me. I did it. Yes.
But it ain't me. Certainly not the sound of parties, Elamine, or
nope,
anything.
Nope. Nothing joyous.
No, nothing good. It's also, though, the sound of last call. Last week, we asked you about the mounting calls for Canada to boycott or relocate the Winter Olympics out of Beijing. Amidst obviously concerns over China's human rights abuses. And since our last episode, we should point out that Parliament has now voted to label China's persecution of the Uyghur population a genocide. It was a non-binding motion. And I should point out that Cabinet abstained from voting on it in any way. Mm-hmm. It also called on the government to lobby the International Olympic Committee to move the Winter Olympics out of China. So all that to say, MPs have had their say. We did ask you, should Canada participate in the 2022 Games in Beijing?
And man, we heard a lot from so many people on this one. Mm. One person wrote in, "If genocide isn't a reason to boycott, what is?" Pretty straight to the point. Another person said, "Boycotting the Olympics will do nothing. Going to the Olympics and making sure the genocide and Canadian detainees are brought up continuously during the Games would do more. Bring the protest to their front door with the world watching." Someone else suggested, "RPM has stated that Canada has committed genocide in relation to First Nations peoples. If we boycott the China Games based on their committing genocide, it leaves Canada vulnerable to boycotts the next time Canada hosts the Games."
Okay. Another person tweeted, "The 2020 Olympics should be canceled. Move the 2020 Games from Beijing to Tokyo. What do people think will happen if athletes try to protest against the treatment of Uyghurs or abuses in Hong Kong?"
I like this thinking, but also like that facilities are just different. One is a Summer Olympics,
yeah,
the other is a Winter Olympics.
Right.
But anyway, that's just neither here nor there. You can't luge on a gymnastics thing, but anyway. I like the thinking, though. I like the thinking. And I've got one last one to share. This person said, "The Canadian Olympic Committee needs to work with other countries to put pressure on the IOC to sanction China or move the Games. A threshold needs to be agreed upon for a group boycott. At what point do we all bail? Mm. A lone Canadian boycott wouldn't have the impact we hope to see, and China doesn't deserve the tourism and sponsorship dollars if they don't agree to fix things."
Lots of opinions. So this week,
yes,
we want to know something about our last topic there. Should the federal government move more aggressively towards decriminalizing possession of small amounts of illicit drugs? You can tweet us your answer to that question. I'm at Rosie Barton.
And I'm at Elamine88. Please throw in the hashtag. The hashtag is PartyLines, and let us know what you think.
Did I mention I got a haircut from our last podcast?
Oh my God, how dare you bring this up right
it's
now?
It's not relevant, but I feel I wanted to leave you on a
like
high note.
Like a dagger in my heart. Like a dagger in my heart.
That's it for Party Lines this week from CBC News and CBC Podcasts. I'm Rosemary Barton, chief political correspondent for CBC News, looking good on the TV.
And I'm Elamine Abdul Mahmoud, chief nemesis of Rosemary Barton and culture writer for BuzzFeed News.
All right, goodbye.
See you next week.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.